Welcome to Gospel Tangent Podcast. I'm Rick Bennett. Emma Smith often vacillated between accepting and rejecting polygamy. In our next conversation with Dr. Bill Smith, we'll talk about how she vacillated between these two extremes. Check out our conversation. Before you do that, I just wanted to mention one other thing. Please tell one of your friends about this podcast. We'd like to let as many people know about this as possible. And also subscribe on iTunes. Now back to our conversation. Going back, tying this back to Emma, it doesn't sound like this argument about concubines really held a lot of water with her.
Like I said, she was up and down about it. So at some point, apparently in May 1843, she had accepted the idea, at least in a limited way. Then later she becomes very negative about it. And during this period where the revelation is given, July 12th, 1843, she has become very, very negative about the idea. We don't know everything that happened with her, what she heard. She was in part of the deep part of the Relief Society, and you know how in small towns, Nauvoo was a relatively small town. We would think of it today. In those days, it was a fairly large place, but now we think of it. So you knew practically everybody, and people talked about what they saw, who was doing what. And so the kind of knowledge base that Emma had, we don't know for sure, but she probably had her finger on what was going on in the female population and the male population of Nauvoo.
Well, let me ask you this. So, because that kind of surprised me a little bit. You said it seemed like in 1843, before the revelation was given, so this is before July, that she kind of was supporting it a little bit, and then it was after, or somewhere around July is probably where she got very negative on that. I wasn't aware of that. Where do you get that information?
She was sealed to Joseph in May 1843, so something positive has happened there in terms of her acceptance of the idea of polygamy, because at least the narrative in those days, the notion of sealing and polygamy were very closely connected. Sometimes they were separated. People could be sealed without being involved in polygamy. There are instances of that. It's very rare to see somebody sealed who isn't already married.
So she was sealed, was that 1842?
1843, she sealed to Joseph.
Do you know what month that was?
May.
So between May and July, she seems to have changed.
She has these up and down cycles, yeah. So, and I don't know what necessarily what drove that.
Now, was there something, because I know by 1842, Joseph had been sealed to dozens, probably.
We'd have to say married. I don't understand what the theological components were of his plural marriages. Are they all sealings, or are they something else? I don't think that's completely clear.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Fanny Alger, or Alger, I guess. I don't know how you say her
name. Okay, but I don't talk about her in the book.
You don't talk about her in the book. Well, the reason why I do want to bring this up, if I could, is this kind of goes back to a little bit of an argument with Mark Staker. He says that when Peter, James, and John came to Joseph in 1830, 1831, I guess that date's a little fuzzy, that Joseph received the sealing power that early. Now, typically, we look at DNC 110, which is 1836, which is when Elijah came to the Kirtland Temple. I just had a very interesting interview with John Hamer and Locke Mackay of the Community of Christ to get their perspective on DNC.
Two great guys, yeah.
Yeah. And so that was really interesting. And I know Mark has tried to make the case that Joseph had the sealing power as early as 1830, we'll just say 1830, and then that Elijah restored the keys. So there's some sort of separation between sealing and keys, a distinction that Mark's making there. So a lot of people look at 1836 as when the keys for sealing were restored. And depending on when you date the whole Fanny Alger incident, it was either before or after Elijah appeared. So do you have an opinion there on Mark's argument there? Is, you know, was the ceiling?
It's the modern narrative of what we think of as priesthood in the Elders' Church sort of creates this problem, or creates a question. It's probably a better way to say it. And I think that this whole thing is developing through from 1830 to 1844. It's in a process of development. And the 1830-ish, 1829, 1832, whatever you end up dating the Peter, James, and John thing, it appears really first in literature by 1835 in the Doctrine and Covenants. And then, but there are probably some earlier references to it, people thinking that or relating much later that he talks about this experience and puts his own hands upon his head to illustrate what happened with Peter, James, and John. So 1833-ish, something like that.
Is when we get first public accounts of it.
Well, but they're reminiscent.
Right.
So, yeah. So we don't know exactly when he first starts talking about that. But also there's a lot of confusion about terminology.
I'll agree with that.
Two of the biggest issues are the terms high priesthood and Melchizedek priesthood. Early on, 1831 is when high priesthood starts getting used. It doesn't have, it only has glancing connection to the notion of Melchizedek priesthood. This idea of Melchizedek and Aaronic priesthood doesn't really show up until April 1835. At least it doesn't become codified until then. So all the times before that in Revelations before that, when you see, say, the term high priesthood, it really means high priest. So 1831 is when high priests are first ordained in that conference in June 1831. And that's a very big deal theologically at the time. It's sort of, I won't say suppressed, but we ignore it now. But it's really important. And in the book, it's really important. So that's why I'm kind of harping on it. But interesting stuff. That whole issue of priesthood, Peter, James, and John, Elijah, the Elijah revelation, by the way, is basically top secret. It doesn't really appear in public until the same time that the Pleuromagi revelation appears in public, which is 1852, so a long time after that.
Well, now Brian Hales told me that there were some contemporary accounts of it right away. I know it wasn't canonized for 40 years, but he said there were some contemporary accounts of it in 1830, shortly after 1836, I believe.
William W. Phelps mentioned something about there being the coming of Christ is near, even at the doors, and he seems to have a some kind of knowledge of what happened in this vision. And Oliver Cowdery's brother, Warren Cowdery, records in Joseph Smith's diary for that date, April 3rd, 1836. In fact, that's the last entry in that diary there's no more diaries of Joseph Smith for a couple of years. But he knew about it, obviously, because he reported what they told him. He reports it in the third person in the diary. There's some evidence that a few people knew about it, but it's not public. And Joseph never talks about it. Oliver Cowdery never mentions it. In his rehearsal in 1850-ish, when he comes back to the church, talks about his experiences. He certainly mentions Peter, James, and John the Baptist, never says a word about this big vision.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Bill Smith. In our next conversation, we'll address rumors about Oliver Cowdery's polygamy. Are these true rumors?
That, I think, is wrong. I think it developed out of a story that happened because before Oliver left on his Lamanite mission to the borders of the Lamanites in Missouri, He's with Parley Pratt and a couple other guys. They're going to be missionaries out there to the Lamanites. And so they could get commissioned by Relation to do this. Before he leaves, he has asked Elizabeth Whitmer to marry him. So he's engaged to her. On the way through Ohio, he meets another woman there, falls madly in love with her, asks her to marry him. That's the extent of any Cowdery polygamy.
Thank you so much for listening. Make sure that you like our page on facebook.com/gospeltangents. You can subscribe at YouTube at youtube.com/gospeltangents. We're also on Twitter at gospeltangents, as well as make sure that you subscribe on iTunes so you don't miss any of our episodes. Thanks again for listening. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here you'll see some more of our videos. Thanks again.